Now we're going to pull in the philosophy that some of the philosophy from that story, because there is something deeper there. So same doctor, and I've pulled out some of the things. Pulled out a few things that I would just like you to think about, because we're going to go from this. We're going to go right into the next presentation.
Now, what is it that is delayed? Two traits. The first is not the one after which the disorder is named. In that sense, the disorder has been misnamed. The first deficit to appear is inhibition, a failure to develop it appropriate inhibition of your behavior. And this will often emerge in the preschool years. And its first sign is usually hyperactivity, though it doesn't need to be so. But it typically is. You have an individual who is behaving too much, who is not suppressing irrelevant behavior the way other children are able to do. We will see this in their motor actions. There's a lot of action coming out of this child. We will see it in their verbal behavior. There's a lot of words coming out of this individual. And we will see it in their intrusive and disruptive motor and verbal behavior as well. But along with that, there is a cognitive impulsiveness. This snap decision making, this quickness to do the first thing that pops into your head without due delay and due diligence, thinking about what the consequences will be. And then we will also see the restlessness, not just the gross motor activity, but the seat restlessness, which I think affects their school performance more than the gross motor activity does. But this will decline with age, so that is why hyperactivity is no longer the name of this disorder, because it declines steeply, and by adolescence, it's nearly gone, and by adulthood, it's an internal state. It's a feeling inwardly of a need to be busy and doing multiple things. And it's a busyness of one's mind, one's ideas. There is a restless quality to their cognition, but not to their outward behavior. In fact, our research has shown that hyperactivity is of no diagnostic value in adulthood. In fact, being restless is more associated with anxiety disorders by the time you're 30 than it is being associated with ADHD. We just don't pay attention to it. It's of no relevance to diagnosis.
I'm going to stop right there because I think this is a good point. There's a few other videos, but there's a few other parts of it. Actually, no, I've got to go back to it. But here's why I'm going to stop. Let's get off stop share. So this is some theory. This is some of my own theory that I've built up over a couple of years, or just in thinking about myself and thinking about that story. The story that we talked about, or the story that I wrote, it's about the other wolf. It's about what happens if you suppress a certain side of yourself or repress a certain side of yourself. So I like to use the concept of the hunter-gatherer. If we take away all these buildings, take away all of this, all these modern things that we have, and we take ourselves back to just living on the land, the idea that there is a hunter and there is a gatherer. A gatherer, by definition, is somebody that prepares, that plans, that prepares for the long winter, that is long-term thinking by definition, that is risk-averse. What is the hunter? What is that other person? What do they look like? Well, a hunter is somebody that's willing to risk their life for the benefit of society. They are willing to, in essence, they are short-term thinking by definition, by design. If you're really, a danger approaches the community. I like a saber-toothed tiger. Saber-toothed tiger attacks the community. The rational, long-term thing to do is to turn and flee and to run. More likely to live another day, more likely to be able to provide for your family. It's irrational to turn and to fight that danger, to fight that stressor. But that person, theoretically, cares deeply for society, so much so that they're willing to risk their life. But not only that, that means that they're irrational and they make snap decisions, just like the doctor was talking about. They act before they think. There has to be a disconnect. How else will you go and sacrifice your life? How, like, if you thought about it, certainly the person understands that they're doing something risky, but perhaps there is something deeper there. Perhaps there is, as I'm suggesting, another person or another wolf or another part of yourself. And it's not necessarily, well, if you take the story, and I think that this applies, that both sides are well, there's both sides inside yourself. Maybe it's a masculine, maybe it's a feminine, maybe it's an alpha, an omega, hunter, gatherer. But the concept is absolutely contrary to that reasonable and prudent person. So maybe not everybody is a reasonable and prudent person. And perhaps there is something that society does to this other person that makes them unhealthy and makes them toxic. So let's just jump right into, let's continue with the video here. I think he talks about, I'll just jump to this, some things that he talks about.
The idea which we have gotten rid of, that it affects your emotions. For the first 170 years of the history of ADHD in the medical literature, which began in 1798, not 1902, 8 years ago, the last remaining copy of a medical textbook was discovered at Kent State University. This textbook was written by the Scottish physician, then living in colonial America, Alexander Crichton. And Crichton had written a medical textbook in which there is a chapter entitled Diseases of Attention. And it is the first description of this disorder. And it's very good, by the way. So ADHD did not begin in 1902. It started in 1798, as far as the first initial medical reference. And from that point on, until 1976, emotion was part of ADHD. Every major theorist, every paper, every science paper, including that of Mark Stewart, one of the first major scientific descriptions, the Canadian papers by Weiss and Heckman and Wary and Douglas and others back in the 60s and 70s, all included emotional impulsiveness as part of this disorder. But the DSM parsed it aside and made it an associated problem in some people. It isn't. It is as much a core feature of this disorder as is any other symptom in the DSM. And that was our mistake. And it needs to be returned to our understanding of ADHD. By emotional impulsiveness, I mean this quickness to anger, to be easily excitable, to have low frustration tolerance, to be easily angered by things around you, and to display your emotions much more quickly than other people do. Now, this is not a mood disorder, even though it starts to look like one. Mood disorders are where you are generating too much emotion. What ADHD is a failure to regulate normal emotion. It is a self-regulation disorder. The feeling you're having is normal. That you are not moderating it is not. It is this inability to self-soothe, to self-calm, and to then moderate the emotion to be more acceptable for the context and for what you hope to accomplish here, the goal that is at hand. Your long-term welfare is at stake. Can you modify that emotion to be more socially acceptable, to be less costly, less damaging? That is as much a part of ADHD as anything else. And we are pushing the DSM-5 committees, there are several, to reincorporate emotional impulsiveness and this emotional dysregulation as being a part of this disorder, because it loads on this dimension. You cannot be impulsive in your behavior and not be impulsive in your emotions. That is impossible because they are a unity. They go together. Emotion is welded to everything you say and do. Sometimes it is benign and bland. Other times it is powerful and intense. It is the emotional coloring of the behavior we display. If you are impulsive in one, you must be in the other. That needs to get reintroduced back into ADHD for a number of compelling reasons, not just because historically it was always there, but because it explains so much more than the current view of ADHD explains. As I will show you, ADHD children are 11 times more likely to develop oppositional defiant disorder within 2 years of the onset of their ADHD. Why? What do those disorders have to do with each other? Now they're treated as simply comorbidity. Oh, well, they go together, but we're not sure. But if you put emotion back into ADHD, you see the connection right into ODD, because everybody with ADHD is automatically subclinically ODD at the get-go. It's only going to take one more symptom to cross the diagnostic threshold. In other words, ADHD causes ODD. That is an important thing to understand, because the ODD, while it does have some social influences over it, half of ODD is the inability to manage frustration, impatience, and anger. And that will set you up for the second component of ODD, which is interaction, conflict, defiance, arguing. But the first four symptoms of the eight in ODD are mood, anger, temper, hostility, easily annoyed, irritability. And that is part of ADHD.
I hope you're starting to get uncomfortable, because this makes me uncomfortable. Defiance. I mean, what is defiance? Defiance in certain contexts is just asking why. In a young child in a classroom, it always asks why. Some people consider that defiance. Our history, get up on a little bit of a soapbox here, our history is defiance. It's part of what makes our country great. And there are connections here. What are we doing when we consider that there's only one kind of person out there? I'm not negating everything we've talked about for ADD and stuff like that. There is, but I am going to challenge, this is what I'm challenging, that there is only one type of person we want to be. So what are we doing to this other person? Or inside of yourself, that you're defiant, that you have raw emotion, that's a bad thing? I'm just going to keep going. Sorry, just one second.
I just
hit the screenshot. Well, people online, you can.
Variation in the people sitting in this room and their ability to manage their behavior is not from how they were raised. It is a part of who they are. It is a part of their neurogenetic gifts. And that is very stunning indeed. That our capacity for regulating ourselves is a neurobiological trait, not some socially learned phenomena that you just happen to pick up from your parents. Grow up. That is a neurobiological trait, and it unfolds as the brain unfolds. It is an instinct, and so is self-control. But self-control can be reduced to these five things. What are the five things you do to yourself? These are the things your child struggles to do. Number one, can you stop? Can you wait? Because as Rabelais said in the novel Gargantuan, which most of you have never read, I'm sure, but it is where this phrase comes from. Everything comes to those who can wait. The waiting is the tough part. You must build in a pause between the event and what you plan to do about it. And in ADHD, there is no pause. The event happens and your response is up, out, done. It is as if there was no front part to the brain. It is as if you were like any other species with a spinal cord. Event, response. Or as in a Gary Larson cartoon, remember The Far Side? Two amoebas, a husband and wife, talking to each other. One amoeba, the wife, of course, says to her husband, stimulus, response. Don't you ever think?
Characterizes ADHD right there. Don't you ever think? Once you stop, you will engage in four subsequent actions. The first is mental imagery. You will recall the past, and you will play a DVD of it in your head. You have a theater in your mind. It is your visual imagery system, the mind's eye. So your child not only cannot stop, they cannot visualize.
And so originates as well as other
the voice in your head. And that voice in your head is there for one very important reason. It's to help control yourself. You start telling yourself what to do, and it starts to work. And now any family I would explain this to would understand that not only can your child not stop, not only do they not have the mind's eye, they don't have the mind's voice. And what is there is very weak. It's not controlling them. So now you know why they can't do what you tell them to do. They can't follow instructions. They can't follow rules. They can't internalize the rules of the situation, because everything I have just said requires a voice in your head, and they don't have. The next comes from the first three, and that is the mind's heart, the ability to manage your emotions so that they are more socially acceptable, so that they are consistent with your goals, not conflicting with your welfare. And so we will see the ADHD child, as we've already described them, easily frustrated, quick to anger, impatient, and just overall more excitable and more emotional than others. But what gets lost in this explanation is something more fundamental. Our emotions are our motivations. If you cannot manage your emotions, you cannot manage your motivation either. Because the fourth executive ability is the source of self-motivation. Self-motivation is the fuel tank for all future directed behavior. There is no getting ready for tomorrow if there is no self-motivation. So what has the ADHD child lost here? They cannot motivate themselves. What does that mean? It means that you will always be dependent on the environment around you and its immediate consequences for how hard and how long you can work. And if there are no consequences in that context, you cannot work. You cannot persist. You will not get it done.
Is that what we want? Work, 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 work all the time. When the doctor and I were talking, we've shifted to this. It's in here at the school, I was directed to this doctor by a friend of mine who specializes in ADD because he's nationally renowned. But how do we always want that? Do we always want productivity? What about rest? What about enjoyment? What about spice of life? What about passion, desire, frustration, all of that stuff? Do we want to eliminate that? And that's why at the beginning of the slide, I framed the rest of the day now is going to focus on what about risk versus control? When we try and control everything in our world, what do we lose? There's one more video, and then we're going to shift right away into Mr. Kaufman's presentation.
Is gone. You do not plan ahead. You live in the moment. This is going to rob you of your sense of time, because the sense of time comes from looking back to look ahead, looking across time and knowing where I'm going. You will not have a subjective sense of time, and that alone is going to be a devastating adult disability. You have the consummate disorder of time management. It's no wonder they're always late.